Hey there, I'm Tal Zlotnitsky from Ignite IT Consulting. You know me from the Braving Business podcast, but when I'm not behind the mic, I'm helping tech startups and established companies ignite their full potential. I also help entrepreneurs and businesses in distress reset for success. With over three decades of entrepreneurial success, I bring hands-on experience to drive growth, navigate turnarounds, raise capital, and lead through innovation. Whether it's executive coaching or strategic transformation, I'm here to turn your business challenges into success stories. Visit igniteitconsulting.com and let's spark that change together. That's igniteitconsulting.com. Your journey to business brilliance starts now.
And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Hello, PJ. How are you, sir?
Oh, dude. I'm amazing. How are you?
I'm well. I'm excited for this incredible interviewee.
It is.
Talk to our audience today.
In fact, I don't even care about what's going on in our personal lives. We have an amazing guest on the show. Do you mind if I just jump in and...
Just jump in, man. Just
pontificate about this gentleman. So on the show today, our guest is the legend in the music industry and a figure who has shaped some of the most iconic careers in modern music, Mr. Matthew Knowles. Known widely as Beyoncé's father, Matthew Knowles is much more than a renowned parent. He's also a successful music executive and entrepreneur and author and a professor. With a career spanning over three decades, Matthew has displayed a pivotal role in the rise of Destiny's Child and the solo careers of Beyoncé and Solange Knowles. His strategic vision and business acumen has earned him numerous awards and recognition in the music and entertainment industry. He's the founder of Music World Entertainment, also known as MWE, which is one of the world's leading music and entertainment conglomerates with record sales exceeding 450 million worldwide, which is nuts. In addition to his music career, but wait, there's more, Matthew lectures on entrepreneurship and the music business and has authored several books. Among them, The DNA of Achievers, 10 Traits of Highly Successful Professionals, Public Relations and the Media, PR Strategies for the Digital Age, and more personally significant books like Racism from the Eyes of a Child, The Emancipation of Slaves Through Music, and Destiny's Child, The Untold Story. Matthew, Tal and I are absolutely thrilled to have you on the Braving Business podcast today to talk about your journey, the challenges that you faced, your instincts on overcoming adversity and achieving success, and hopefully, you know, some backstage passes and some cool merch. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you guys are. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited about just having a conversation.
Awesome.
Excellent. Well, as are we. Matthew, it's a great honor and a privilege to speak to you today. We were so glad when your team reached out to us about you being on the show, and we're looking forward to you sharing a lot of wisdom with our audience. Let's start from the beginning. I usually ask our guests to talk about their early childhood and the impact it had on their lives. And in your case, you actually published a book in 2017 based in part on your experiences called Racism from the Eyes of a Child, where you wrote about integrating all white schools in the South and trace your family's roots from post-slavery to the civil rights era. Will you share with our audience a little bit about your childhood and maybe some key lessons you learned from it that shaped your outlook on life?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. You know, I was born in 1952, so you guys do the math on that. It's kind of easy, 52 to today. 72, that's what you would get. So, you know, back then, I grew up in Gaston, Alabama. George Wallace was governor of Alabama. It was tough. Segregation was a thing. My mom went to high school with Coretta King. Also, Andrew Young's wife was at the same high school. So there was something in the water in Marion, Alabama. And my mother, when she left that little town, you know, she took up the torch of integration and desegregation. So I never went to a black school. Can you imagine growing up in Gaston, Alabama, 1952, going to elementary school in 1958 through, and then high school 1970, never going to a black school.
Wow.
I integrated all the way up to the University of Tennessee, I also desegregated, integrated that as well. It was tough, but my parents were my inspiration. I'm third generation entrepreneur. My mom always said to me and encouraged me that I could be whatever I wanted to be in life if I put in the work. My dad was a truck driver, but he convinced those folks, let him use that truck, and he would go tear down old houses, buy old cars that were abandoned, they sell all the parts of the car, sell the wood, aluminum metals of the house, and would make almost 20 times more a week than he was making as a truck driver. My mother was a colored maid, making $3 a day. She convinced that woman she worked with, white woman she worked for, to give her all the hand-me-downs. And on the weekend, my mother and her two best friends made these beautiful quilts that, again, she made 20, 30 times more. My grandfather owned 200 acres of land, was a farmer, but more importantly, he was the regional moonshine district. So I come from an entrepreneurial family, and that's where I think I get my roots. That's where I got my encouragement for entrepreneurship.
Wow. Wow. So definitely you're coming from a history of hustle culture, as we would say in today's vernacular. And also just a side note, at 72, you look better than I do at 55. So, you know, I'll have what he's having. but so, you know, you grew up through these tough areas. You had parents who were extremely entrepreneurial, right? I love the fact that your father was so open-minded to see opportunities in small things, which is great. Same thing with your mom. I'm assuming that you kind of like wanted to make sure that your children didn't have the same type of hardships that you did when you were growing up. I mean, you saw a huge cultural change during that time from the 50s to the 70s. What was that like when you held beautiful little Beyonce and beautiful little Solange in your arms when they were, you know, wee little things? What was that like? Like, what did you have in your heart to say, like, how am I going to make things better for them and get them ready for success?
Well, the first thing I had in my heart is love. You know, holding your child for the first time is a moment. I always just wanted my kids to find their passion, whatever that was in life. I didn't want to be the parent and say, you'll be this, you'll be that. I wanted them to find themselves and encourage them. That was very important to me and my former wife, to be those type of parents.
That's awesome. When did they start showing like what you thought were real passions? Like, was it, you know, 'cause sometimes you hear of children being like, you know, musically inclined or theatrically inclined, very young. Sometimes it's older. Like, what were there any, like, you know, clear bells off your, you know, ringing in your head, like, oh, these girls are destined for music?
Well, music was, you know, always at our home, all types of music. You know, so they grew up with that. I grew up with music. So the thing for Beyonce is she was in elementary school, won a competition against older kids, and she was kind of upset that it took, the show was longer than anticipated. And she said to us, Mom, Dad, I'm ready to go up there and perform so I can win my trophy, my $100. And I was like, well, how do you know that? She says, well, I know that. She gets on the stage and we look at each other like, is that our daughter? Because she completely changed once she got on that stage. And that was a defining moment that we knew maybe she's passionate about this.
That's amazing.
When I hear that story, I think back, and it just so happened PJ and I recently did an interview with the writer of the number one best-selling book, was it The Buddha Who Drove a Bentley? That's the name of the book, believe it or not. great book. And a segue into that book was a conversation about Richard Williams, the father of Venus and Serena Williams. And it so happened that I just recently, this past weekend, watched a movie, King Richard. Mm-hmm. And one thing he had a difficult childhood himself, and he spoke a lot about his vision for his children. And one thing he is famously known to have said is that he had two Michael Jordans growing up in his home. He really saw his daughter's talent in ways that other people didn't. Did you perceive, I mean, first of all, were you already in the music industry when you realized your daughters were special?
No. In fact, 20 years in corporate America with Xerox, Philips Medical Systems, and Johnson & Johnson. So I was doing my thing, happened to be the number one sales rep in the world for Xerox Medical Systems. So I wasn't that dad. I wasn't the Joe Jackson. I wasn't Mr. Williams. That is not the kind of parent I was of forcing my kids to do things. I wanted it to be their love and passion.
Gotcha. And so that's both incredible in the fact, in the sense that they ultimately became what they became. A lot of times for children who achieve success beyond anyone's imagination, it is either a parent that drives them or some deep inherent passion. Did you know that they had something special? I mean, at what point did you realize there's something about these girls and what they're, what they're willing to do?
Well, you know, Beyonce, as a kid, she would compete in these pageants, not as we never, ever wanted her to be in a beauty pageant, but those beauty pageants had a music competition part, and she would compete in those. And, you know, after she won, 20 consecutive competition as a little child, then you start saying, maybe she has something. But she was very, very, very passionate and focused on what she wanted to be when she grew up. And she would always use the word, "Dad, I want to be an entertainer," which I love, because being a singer and being an entertainer is so different.
That is awesome. I've been thinking about how, you've watched them grow and you've watched them go through, like, just, the small stage and the off, town beauty pageant or whatever those competition opportunities were. So first of all, I just want to say there must have been a moment when your daughters were just kicking it and you were like, wow. Like there had to have been an oh wow moment where I'm sure, like, as things are rolling and they're gaining traction and they're doing better and they're getting more notoriety and the record sales are going and all that. That's all wonderful. But was there a point, like, was there a certain concert or was there a point where you were like, wow, that's a wow moment? And then I'm going to get back to a more serious question. But was there a moment for you where you're like, holy crap, this is something big?
It's happening. This is happening.
Well, for me, it was a little different, guys. For me, my old wow moment was when the Beyonce's girl group, they weren't called Destiny's Child, called Girls Time. They lost on Star Search. And they competed against some 40-year-old rock band, if you could believe it. They had 12, 13. And I went to Ed McMahon after they lost and said, "Hey, I'm just a dad. I'm not the dad that's, I'm doing my thing." So, and he says, "Mr. Knowles, I don't know why. Everyone that moves on the show go on to be successful, but the people that consistently win don't." And he says, "I think the reason is they go back, they refocus, they rededicate, and they make changes." That's when I became their manager. That was the defining moment for me in Beyonce's career, where I then said, "I have to be a part of this."
And how did it feel? I mean, balancing the role of a father and a manager. And I know, at some point you stopped being your manager, but there was a time where you were doing both. How did you balance that? I mean, it's got to be, it's got to be not the easiest thing in the world to do.
Yeah, let's set the record straight. Beyonce's girl group was not the first management client. My first management client that I got a major record deal way before the girls was a rapper in Houston. So, the record is not completely straight. That's why I love doing these interviews, because people really don't know what really happened. We know the Jedi mind trick, the media has positioned that he left his job at Xerox to go manage his daughter. Well, that's not even true. I sold MRI and CT scanners for 4 years and was a neurosurgical specialist for 4 years before I did this. So I love these opportunities just to set it, the record straight.
Well, we appreciate that. I mean, and you know, we try to ask the questions that, you know, we think are in people's minds, and ultimately, it actually leads me to my next question, which is around the topic of dealing with setbacks. It's something that you're quoted as saying. You're quoted as saying failure is a primer for future success. You wrote about that in your book. I'd love to know what you mean by that. Maybe you can share a personal story that resonates with you when it comes to that principle.
Yeah, I talk about the DNA of achievers. Failure, I have a little chapter. Failure is opportunity to grow, not a reason to quit. And oftentimes we quit when we begin to have failures. We don't evaluate and learn from them, see that as opportunities. I see when I make a mistake, I see that as an opportunity to become better. I've never became better because I did everything right. I became better because I did some things wrong and I learned from those in my professional life and personal. So I encourage that. That's part of life. If you're a risk taker, you're going to make some mistakes and those things are going to happen. So I encourage learning from that, growing from that.
I love it. I love that kind of positive attitude, because, you know, we see a lot of people who, we all face failures, and you can either have it be a defining moment where you make a huge pivot, you stop, make a huge pivot, or you learn from it. And so I think it's super important what you're saying in that, take it and then just grow and use that opportunity to grow. I think that's awesome.
And you know what? One thing that's a consistent theme on this podcast, people that listen to a lot of our episodes will recognize it, is that generally speaking, people like you have accomplished a lot of things in their lives, are not afraid to talk about failure. They recognize that failure is part of their story, and oftentimes a very important part of the story, a part of the story that led them to a place that allowed them to reach certain capabilities or aspects of their personality and their career that they wouldn't have otherwise experienced, because it sometimes takes a setback to help you recognize what you're capable of or what you want to do, what you want to be passionate about. It's not often that, you know, you talk to someone who's accomplished as much as you have on so many different in so many different areas, right? So you could have simply, you know, enjoyed the opportunity to be a parent of a mega successful superstars, but you were previous to that already a hugely accomplished person in the entrepreneurial world. You continued from that to also choose to be a writer, choose to manage other artists, choose to start the label, etc. Talk to us about that. What is, you know, you seem to have a passion for achievement. Where does that come from?
Well, again, I think who we all are comes from parenting and our childhood. And I've talked about my example of having great, wonderful parents. But let's talk about it. That's a good question, because tell everything I've done in life, I didn't know anything about it. My former wife and I, she wanted to be a hairstylist. So she went back to school and we developed and created the largest hair salon in Houston. I didn't know anything about that industry. Then we went into the music industry. I didn't know anything about that industry. We went into apparel, like clothing line, House of Daria. We ended up selling it in 7 years for $75 million. I didn't know anything initially about that business. I went to the medical division of Xerox. I didn't know anything about Xerox radiography, but I went to the library every day. And I researched and I studied and I went to seminars. And I went back to school because knowledge is power. Knowledge is power in getting the information. So my success has been built on fundamentals. There's fundamental things that we all do that make us successful, a business especially. And knowing that, again, getting the knowledge.
That is... First of all, as you recount all the successes that you had, and after Tal laid out them as well, it is kind of mind-boggling, right? Like you're all over the place in regards to industries, and yet you've had the Midas touch, which is phenomenal. And God bless you. That's awesome. Is there a commonality that you see through all that? Is there like all the tables are different, but the only main common denominator is
the common denominator,
right?
Yeah, it's yes. You.
So what's the secret sauce? Like what are you bringing to that table that's spicing it up?
Well, first of all, I don't do anything that I'm not passionate about. But second of all, my success really comes, I want to always give credit to Xerox Corporation, who had the best marketing and sales training of any organization in the 80s and 90s. I learned so much. Marketing is my thing. Marketing is for me. It's not a step. It's what differentiates whatever we're doing from everyone else. What is that? Destiny's Child. Most people didn't understand was built around female empowerment. Their songs were about female empowerment and knowing who your audience is and knowing how to approach your audience. You know, and again, what differentiates you? You know, why would we buy Nike over another brand? Or we go to Target over in Walmart? You know, it's about marketing. That's what's differentiated us, is our knowledge of marketing.
It's interesting because I'm thinking about a theme that's in your book, which is strategic vision. And essentially what you're saying, I mean, when we talk about marketing, it's about recognizing, setting a certain path for yourself or believing that there is a certain approach you want to take and then pursuing it with precision and with vigor. Talk to us about this belief you have that having a strategic vision is essential to building a successful career. First, you know, what kind of advice could you give our audience about how to develop and fine tune a strategic vision? How do you even start? And, you know, how did you apply it to your own career?
So the question is with anybody that's listening, get on an airplane and the pilot says, "Hey, welcome to flight 1605. We're on our way to Los Angeles, but I have no idea how we're going to do that because I don't have a flight plan." I think most people be like, "Ding, ding, ding. I think I'll take the next."
Heck yeah.
But most of us, that's what we do. We don't have a flight plan. And that flight plan in business and in life has to sometimes, I remember having on the walls just tons of notes on a 5-year plan for Beyonce, not a 1 year, but a 5 year. How we were, what were those steps? So it's about having a strategic plan, not just a plan, but a strategic plan, a strategy. How are you going to get there?
I think that's amazing. But you know, sometimes though, it's a trap, right? Like sometimes people overplan and they get lost in the weeds, and so. How do you keep yourself moving through that strategic plan? How are you setting, you know, I'm assuming you're setting a large goal and then you're tactically building the steps to go towards it. But sometimes people get mired in that process, right? Like it's an analysis paralysis, as it's called. So like, how do you get through that?
Now, for me, it's always been having the right team. You know, you guys have spoken to some of my team, my assistant has been with me 23 years. My entertainment attorney has been with me 12 years. I can go on and on. But having a strategic team, I can't do it all. I can come up with the strategy, but what I'm not good is doing the work to implement it. That's not my forte. My forte is coming up. This is the idea. Now I need you guys to go and implement it. And I think that's what leadership is all about. And building the right team. It's not I, it's we.
You know, I mean, there's no question about that. I also think, though, that it's important for people to understand the meaning of a plan, right? So a plan is different than writing out every step. A plan is about direction. It's a compass, right? And I think what you have done in your daughter's career and your own career, as if you have a North Star, you're going in a certain direction. When I talk to clients, and I'm a consultant, and I help clients prepare plans, a lot of times a key principle that I want to make sure they understand is that the plan is not designed to be foolproof. It's designed to get us to the right places through a process that is iterative and ultimately includes some flexibility. So I'm sure that as you're thinking about a strategic vision, you're not thinking about someone being unable to pivot. Quite to the contrary. How do you balance that? How do you balance the fact that you set a vision for yourself and that life isn't unpredictable, that things come at you that you didn't anticipate, both opportunities and challenges, and require you to adjust?
Well, it goes back to that last word, adjust. You know, change is it's a natural part of our lives. Some people embrace change. Some people fight off. Most people fight off change. But change is the ability to modify and adapt to a situation. And you're so right, Tal. You know, it's not always perfect, because in entrepreneurship, I always say perfection is the enemy of profitability. So I'm not always trying to get perfect, but I want to be prepared when that moment comes. I want my artists to be prepared. I want my team to be prepared when that window of opportunity comes for us. And that requires, again, having a vision. That's why I fly so much, I guess that might have gone over someone's head. I love flying and all the decisions a pilot has to make. Dang, you wouldn't believe all the decisions when the weather changes on a pilot, all the different directions the pilot has to go, the altitudes. I mean, that's why I use the pilot, because there's so much change in that, in a flight. In a flight of our lives, a flight of our business has so many changes. We know where we want to get to, and we have key steps to get there, but you have to have flexibility. You can't be, this is the only way we're going to do it, because that's not going to get you very far. Yeah. You'll want to run out of fuel doing that.
PJ, before your next question, I feel there's something that this example of the pilot brought me to the moments we're in. And I don't usually like to talk politics too much on the show. I have my own views. But there was the George Stephanopoulos interview with President Biden, where he asked President Biden, how would you feel if, you know, you ended up losing? And President Biden said, so long as I gave it my best, I'd feel okay. And I read an op-ed in the New York Times the next day that had the pilot analogy and said, how would you, if you were getting on a plane and the pilot said, look, you know, we're about to take off for LA. I don't know that we'll get there, but I'm going to do my best. And so long as I do my best, I'm going to feel okay. You wouldn't feel so comfortable about that. I think what's really interesting, if I was to connect those two stories, the one that the Matthew told and this op-ed, leadership requires you to be to provide people with comfort. So it's not about being perfect. It's not about not about knowing everything up front, because none of us are capable of that except for the Almighty. It is about giving people confidence that you have the right frame of mind, the right the humility, which, you know, Matthew, in talking about your willingness to learn and study, that indicates that you are not someone that walks into a room thinking you know it all. You take the time, you learn, and people follow leaders like that. So from a leadership standpoint, talk to me about the component of being real and humble to a point. Obviously, people want to follow leaders, but how do you view authenticity and vulnerability in the context of leadership?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Tal. I just think people can see through bullshit. I really do. I think people can sense it, feel it when you're not authentic, when you're just, you know, using buzzwords for just to use buzzwords. Leadership is about having empathy, but one of the critical parts of leadership is listening skills and listening to your people, letting them feel comfortable that they can really be different. You know, I don't want a team. I always use the Chicago Bulls. I think the reason they were so successful is the coach knew that these players were so different. Everyone knew their roles. And I think that's how life is. we're all different, culturally different, knowledge-wise different. But we use that as a asset. We use that to our advantage, that we get in a room and a leader, and you can't have a team without a leader. And that's so important, empathy, listening skills, teaching accountability versus responsibility. Most people don't know the difference between those two. A lot comes with being a leader.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for bringing up Chicago Bulls. I'm in Chicago, so love that. Well, I mean, but it's also, you brought me right back to that team, right, in the 90s. And Phil Jackson, for all the bohemian aesthetic that he brought to the team, he really had to corral a group of superstars. Well, a few superstars, right? Others were more...
role players.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. Yeah. There, a lot of them were role players, but Scottie Pippen, you know, definitely had needs that needed to be met. Dennis Rodman, no needs could be met by that guy. and you had Michael Jordan, who's probably, you know, arguably one of the most competitive people that has ever graced this earth. So to be able to get them to listen, not to everything, but to say, this is the plan. It's called the triangle defense, and this is what we're triangle offense, and this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to run it. And to get these people to do that and buy into it is amazing, right? And I think that is exactly what you're talking about. To be an effective leader, you have to be humble. Phil Jackson never said my way or the highway. He was like, trust me, this is going to work. If we do it the way it's laid out, it's going to work. And it clearly it did. So I think that's, everything that you're saying is just spot on.
So, PJ, did you know I'm one of the initial owners of Chicago Sky? Have been since day one. Very proud to be a
no way.
Yeah, Google it.
How about that?
All right.
Yeah,
I'm gonna tell you.
I have my ring, man. I came 2 years
really?
Ago to the ring ceremony. Yeah,
the Della Don and all those guys. Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing.
So
I got it. I this is not part of what we're going to talk about, but I'm going to share this with you really fast. Years ago, my daughters were in something called Indian Princesses. It's through the YMCA. It's where your dad, as a father, you can spend time outdoors with your kids, you know, go on horseback rides and campfires and stuff like that. For us, more suburbanite type of people. Fantastic organization. So I called the Chicago Sky and I was like, hey, I got a group of young girls. And I would love for them, this is like Chicago Sky maybe been around 5 years at that point. I was like, and I would love to bring them down and go to a game. Can you get, and I was asking to see if we can get a discount on tickets, right? So I spoke to this woman there and she's like, oh yeah, bring them down. I'm like, okay, great. So we go down and she's like, come half an hour early. We're like, fine. We get down there half an hour early. I got like 8 girls. And she's like, all right, come with me. And the players are practicing, you know, they're shooting, they're warming up. So all the girls got to sit underneath the hoop while the people are shooting and then able to pass the ball back to the players. I'm like, oh my God, this is fantastic. And she goes, hey, so by the way, you were in section, I don't remember, whatever. I moved you down to the main floor and you're over here. We're like, oh my God, this is fantastic. So then she sits us down and now it's like 20 minutes before the game. She sits us down. She goes, here's all t-shirts for you guys. So she gave us all t-shirts and then she's like, and I'll be back in a minute. I'm like, okay. So now it's like a couple of minutes before tip off. She comes, gets all the girls, takes us all down on the side of the port, side of the court. And so we're kneeling on the side of the court. They start introducing all the players and it was the Connecticut Sun. So they introduce all the Connecticut Sun players and then they start introducing the Sky and they took all the girls out on center court and gave, and all the players came out and gave a basketball to every girl.
Oh, wow.
Right? And then afterwards, incredible. they made us stay after the game and then they signed all the balls from all the players. And I was like, girls, never go to another professional sport because you're never going to get it as good as this. This is like the amount of outreach, community outreach that the WNBA did was astounding. And it was, it's one of the most feel good moments I've ever had with and I've done a lot in professional sports, not me playing, but you know, I've been to a lot of things and been in a lot of really cool events. Nothing was ever like this with children. So I got to say, and with the Sky, Thank you, sir.
Man, that makes me proud. Makes me proud.
Oh, it's amazing. And you know what? I mean, hearing you tell that story, PJ, and having spoken to Matthew, I'm not surprised at all that the organization takes that kind of mindset. Because again, it's a mindset of being grateful, being humble, being willing to do the hard work, wanting to earn it. And as I've, you know, come across Matthew's work, read some of his books, clearly that seems to be, you know, a theme that, that he espouses and champions, and this team, wherever they are, whether it's in music or professional basketball, pick up on that. So it's not shocking to me. Let's talk about public relations. You know, obviously part of leadership is storytelling. And you wrote the book Public Relations and Media to talk about PR strategies for the age we're in. And you obviously have, you as they say, you've had a trial by fire when you're out there and you're in the public eye. Things happen, things are said, some are true, some are less true. Talk to me about how you manage those pressures, and also what strategies would you recommend to people who are, you know, in the public eye. Aspiring to be the public eye.
Well, I tell you, one of the things I always say, Tal, is you don't have to answer the question. Nobody puts the gun up to your head and say, you have to answer that question. I mean, you learn by reading books like that and attending seminars. Again, it goes back to knowledge. You'll learn how to answer some questions and respectfully say, well, I'd rather not talk about that right now. You learn how to really take control of the interview. And those are skills again. And we will always keep going back to knowledge and getting that knowledge and knowing how. I call the 3-second rule. When someone sees you for the first time, 3 seconds, they form an opinion of you. And being mindful of that, these people, when I step on the stage, are going to form an opinion of me. So what are my initial words? What, how do I look? You know, do I have a look of confidence? All of those things become very, very important in life. But I want to go one thing, because I hope we do talk about it. You said, what's the common thread? Marketing? Yes, one. Passion. Knowing what your passion is the number one thread also. Because when passion and work ethics go together. You can't find someone who works hard that's not passionate about it, because, you know, I always use, I used to play college basketball, PJ. So I use a lot of basketball analogies.
That's fine.
I know you want to go on to something else. I won't continue. I'll let you ask the questions.
Well,
actually it's PJ's question next. So you go, sir.
Well, but look, tell us about the passion, actually, because it's something that, first of all, you've had a career of over 3 decades, right? An astounding career over 3 decades. And you, like, first of all, what keeps you passionate? Like, what keeps you pumped every day when you get up? And the second thing is, I was wondering, what does passion look like to you, right? Because you're saying one of the common themes is passion, and lots of people are passionate about lots of things, but what does that really look like?
That's a good question, PJ, because for me, passion is that thing, that the fire that excites me. You know, I'm excited to have an interview with you guys. You know, the thing that I go to bed at night, you know, I look at my schedule, and I want to be prepared. I research people. I get prepared. That's that excitement that I can't wait. I can't wait till it happens. I think about it. I love educating. That's the thing. Even as a manager, you're educating people. You know, the way I manage is sharing knowledge. I'm not the kind of person that I'm going to hold all of it within. I want people to understand and learn and grow. That's my passion, to educate people. And I love doing it. And I do it in different ways. It's not one way that I educate. And I use my knowledge to really be successful at it. I'll use one quick basketball analogy. Kobe Bryant, a young man I knew well, Kobe had a thing called 666. Basketball season, 6 months. Sorry. After the basketball season, a lot of players will take a break. Not Kobe. He worked the next 6 months of off seasons, 6 days a week. He practiced 6 hours a day. And when I think of Serena and I think of Beyonce, and I can go on these uber highly successful people, that's their work ethic because they're so passionate about it. So to them, it's not work. It's fun. So all the things that people say, God, that's a lot, but I have fun doing it. Like I'm having fun talking to you right now.
You know, it's as I was listening to you speak about passion, first of all, a lot of things jump out at me. Passion to you comes across as influencing, making change, innovating, bringing joy. Some people have a different equation for passion, right? Especially in the day and age we're in. Some people believe that passion is being angry or being judgmental or, you know, you're wrong, I'm right. Doesn't sound like that's it at all for you. It sounds like it is about bringing the best out of people, bringing the best out of yourself, but also bringing the best out of people around you.
It is. It is, Tal. And you're so right, man. We're in a really tough part of the whole world now. And again, it goes back to, I'll keep saying the same thing, and it's about knowledge. Knowledge is so much, gives us so much power when we know. Because I like hearing people's perspectives. I like giving people the feel like they can share the perspective. I mean, I'm not going to, like, you know, judge you. I might learn from your perspective. And I love to learn, man. That's one of the things. I love the research. And so I just look at life. And I made mistakes, man. I went to therapy 10 years. And finally, we understood that a lot of my early life, some of the racial things that I went through, was trauma for me. And so my thing is, I was on opposite extremes, highly successful because of that trauma, but made some really bad personal decisions and failure because of that trauma. And so I had to learn how to also do a lifestyle change. And the universe can be a jokester at times. It'll bring you to your knees. And for me, you know, I'm a cancer survivor. You know, 5 years last week, had my exam, cancer survivor, a very rare thing for men, a male breast cancer. And through that, I had to learn how to, in my current life, how to do a lifestyle change, not work as much, how to take days off, just look out the window sometimes, look at the beauty of nature, take walks, exercise, change my diet, all those things about change for me.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. And, you know, it's remarkable. It's so consistent and it's so uplifting that we've had so many guests. I mean, we've had people on the show that have accomplished unimaginable things, you know, from the Inspector General of the United States Army, the first Major League Baseball players, CEOs that have minted billion-dollar companies, and on and on and on. And one consistent theme that comes across is success in one's career does not mean that your life's perfect, does not mean that you're immune to hardship, it does not mean that the challenges that you face, the trauma that you face doesn't impact you, hasn't shaped you, doesn't cause you to make some decisions you're not proud of. And strength and success is not about avoiding these things. It's about overcoming them. It's about being able to love yourself and be loving to others despite these things. And I believe that's what your life is about. I mean, from where you started, integrating schools to where you are, with your daughter being, you know, one of the most iconic artists in history, and you having accomplished so much on your own, it's mind blowing. And there's no way that type of a journey doesn't come with a whole lot of challenges and issues that impact who you are and make it so that it's almost unavoidable to hit pitfalls and pit stops along the way that set you off track. Being able to come back to yourself, being authentic, being able to come back to yourself is the key, not being perfect.
Well, Tal, I use that for motivation. You know, the other part of my passion is to motivate. So I educate and motivate. And I, again, it's about sharing your life journey. I remember the first book I had, I did the first a book show, and I thought I was going to sell 1,000 books. So I had all these books and I'm pulling up to the hotel and boxes and boxes and boxes. And the bellman put them on, and then we went up to my room and we're walking a hallway. And I'm like, sir, where is my room? He's like, it's at the end of the hall, Dr. Knowles. I was like, when are we going to get there? We're still walking. And then he looked at me and he said, you know, I use these cliches because they're real. Will they really happen to you? And he looked at me, he says, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. And I use that a lot in my life. It's also how we get to the end. We talked about strategies and stuff, but along the way, some bad stuff will happen, some really good stuff. Are you prepared, though? Are you willing to change? Those become the key things. And you know, when you talk about Beyonce and Solange, all of Beyonce's success, I'm most proud. They're just good people. And if they saw the janitor, they would say, good morning. And you never ran any bad stuff. I mean, you know, normally at that level, I never forget a lot of reason the Destiny Child didn't get interviews. Is they would say, Mr. Knowles, the girls haven't done any bad negative stuff, so we can't write about it. That's not to the interview. It's boring.
Well, hey, we'll have them on our show. Look, I
boring as they are, yeah. We'll figure it out. We'll have something to talk to them about. I don't
know. Yeah. Maybe a little country music. Who knows? So actually you brought up something, Mr. Knowles, that I wanted to touch on really briefly, and that is you brought up a battle and surviving male breast cancer. And I think that, first of all, my wife just went through breast cancer. And luckily, knock on wood, she's cancer free. And that was a harrowing battle. How did you find out about it? Because, you know, you don't hear a lot about male breast cancer, and there's a lot of stigma involved in it. I think it would be really interesting to hear how you found out about it, how you attacked it. And also just a side note, a thank you, because my wife, basically her playlist during this fight was your daughter. And absolutely. Yeah. And so it's, you know, when I told her that I was interviewing you today, and she's way more successful than I am. She's an author. She was like, you
not just an author. His wife is an international best-selling author.
PJ is being biased.
But she was like, please tell Mr. Knowles how inspiring his protege, right, Beyonce, has been, as a person, as just like you're saying, the women empowerment. She had everything, you know, all the Destiny's Child, all the Beyonce's categories, or her catalog in her iPad, listening to it all the time. And so I just want to say thank you for that. You know, you in a way had created a lifeline for my wife to hang on to during these hard times. So thank you for that. But also, if you wouldn't mind, just tell us a little bit about your journey with the male breast cancer.
I'll quickly go there. You heard that I worked in the medical division of Xerox, and I was fortunate to be their number one sales rep worldwide for a number of years. We used to have a lot of seminars, educational seminars, the sales and marketing team. And there was an optional seminar, you know, you go and you spend a week, but when you get to Friday, ready to go home, you know, going to those dinners every night. And so it was optional and was going to be on male breast cancer. We were the leading modality for breast cancer in the 80s. The leading modality was zero radiography. So I learned in that seminar some of the traits, some of the things that you can be aware for male breast cancer. Without getting very graphic, one is nipple discharge. Fast forward 5 years ago, I'm wearing white t-shirts, and I look this day and I see these little red dots. Like if you had a white piece of paper, you had a pen, red pen, just put some dots on it. Didn't think anything about it. Second day, red dots. I say to my wife, Gina, I'm seeing these red dots. Like, is these t-shirts defective? What's going on? She said, that's interesting, because when I cleaned the sheets the last 2 days, on your side of the bed was red dots, like looked like blood. That was that was probably the number one factor of knowing for male breast cancer is nipple discharge. And so I immediately called my doctor. He had never heard a male patient ask to get a mammogram. I get a mammogram, sure enough. I have male breast cancer. We have surgery. The beautiful thing about the story was stage 1A, because early detection is the key to health. Early detection. Mm-hmm. So that was how I found out. And by the way, PJ, tell your wife that I'm proud that she loves Survivor, because I co-wrote Survivor.
Aw. Yes, sir. I will.
So we're getting ready to wind down, and I want to ask you a question that anyone in the audience will hear the question will probably chuckle. And the question is, do you feel like you've made it? And there's a reason I'm asking you that question. As you look at your life right now, do you feel like you can just sit back and relax?
No. I know that probably would be good for me in a number of ways. Just retire, do nothing. I have to keep my mind busy and growing and learning. I still learn. You know, I love teaching. I teach in London. I teach at Pepperdine. I love that. I want to write another book. I want to stay busy. And I want to continually, public speaking is my thing around the world, again, to educate and motivate and to share my story. So I enjoy that. I know how to balance it more today than I did years ago. At one point in my life, I just got overwhelmed having offices in L.A., offices in Houston, offices in New York, offices in London, on the plane. You know, I've learned to, at some point of success, we have to know there's a point that you have to stop. You can't continually grow, you implode doing that without at some point saying enough is enough. And now let me enjoy this. Let me enjoy life. You know, my best friend is my wife. We have fun. We laugh. I was just reading something, the 20 things between husband and wife. We laugh every night before we go to bed. Throughout the day, we say several times we love each other. And that's where I am. Just being me, just telling my story. So thank you for giving me this opportunity.
I love that. I want to ask you, you brought up being a professor and, you now educate others on entrepreneurship and the music business. I want to ask you this question. Many professors have a favorite way to start orienting new students toward whatever their main thesis is about life and business. When you first meet a new class, do you have a go-to, a way you start to get your students oriented towards what it is, the real substance of what you want to convey, which is more than about how to the X's and the Y's, right? It's deeper than that. Do you have a go-to for how you start?
Yeah, I do. I mean, every class, I take the time that the first day of class, I want to know each and every one of my students. And I give them an opportunity to say where they're from, what's their major, what's their passion in life, because my thing is to teach them critical thinking, not the course title. I want them to walk away from the end of my class saying, I have a better handle on critical thinking now. Dr. Knowles helped me with to understand passion, all the go-through strategy and steps. And that's also, I want them to speak the first day because the first day is like, you know, uphill. And I want, no, you got to have successful people have energy. They look you in the eye. It's about energy. I could teach you like that, you know, doctor, professor, no. Or I could have energy with it. And so even those little things are teaching moments for me.
That's it. It's energy. I'll tell you what, ultimately, that's it. That's what you're teaching them beyond all else is that in life, it's how you, how you carry yourself and what you convey to the world about yourself and your values has a lot of bearing over how people receive you. It's not the entire ball game. You also have to have substance, but passion is about energy, and energy is often, you know, the sort of common thread that people that are hugely successful have, the combination of passion, energy, and all the other characteristics that you've laid out today.
All right. So
thank you.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. First of all, this has been a very inspiring and amazing chat. So we're so thankful that you're on. I normally don't ask this question. I ask this question of all my friends. So I'm going to ask you guys this question.
I'm with it.
Absolutely. So, and I'm going to ask you to ask or to answer for your daughters as well. What was the first concert you went to, and what was the first concert they went to?
First concert in my life that I ever went to. Ooh, I ever went to Fire in college.
Oh,
wow.
At Fisk University. It was 50 cents. That's how much it cost to get in.
That is amazing. All right. So what was Beyonce and Solange's first concert? Do you remember?
Clearly it was Michael Jackson.
Wow.
Wow.
I mean, we have footage and see Beyonce. Well, Solange was too young. Beyonce was like six or something. And she was so excited. And there was all these little kids outside to see Michael come into rehearsal stuff. We got her there. My wife took her early. And out of all these kids, hundreds of kids, Michael walked over to her and just shook her hand and then walked away. So I don't know if he knew something, the energy or the universe, but that was her first.
That is amazing. Tal, what was your first concert?
You know what? I don't recall. Obviously, I was a singer myself as a child, so it may have been my own. but I don't recall. You know, as you were talking about Michael Jackson, it reminded me that we have had a Michael Jackson sighting in this podcast before. We had the lead singer of Ace of Base, and he talked about going to watch Michael Jackson in Monaco. They were already a major, a well-known band at that time. But to him, Michael Jackson was, you know, the real deal. And he spoke about how Michael invited him and his bandmates to come backstage after his show and told them that he found them inspirational and, you know, how impactful that was. So it's kind of interesting to have Michael Jackson be someone that had, I mean, not shocking, obviously he's had influence on so many musicians, but that would have been Beyonce's first concert.
That's amazing. In Earth, Wind & Fire.
That's just a great story.
Yeah,
our guest today was Matthew Knowles. It's Dr. Matthew Knowles. He told us to say Mr. because he's humble, but it's Dr. Matthew Knowles, a PhD. He's had an incredible career. It's well beyond the careers of his daughters. He's won numerous awards. Again, the founder of Music World Entertainment. It's one of the greatest leading music and entertainment conglomerates in the world. He's a lecturer and a professor. He's an author of wonderful books that I encourage you all to take a look at. You can find him on Amazon, and also a great guy. So, Matthew, it's been a great privilege and an honor to have you on today. And we thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you, guys. Have a wonderful day. Keep sharing this knowledge and information. It's so critical and important what you both do. And I'm glad to have played a small part. So thank you.
You're amazing. Thank you so much. And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard, want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook, visit us on YouTube, and please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.